You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Are you thinking about getting into Dungeons & Dragons? Maybe you're looking to expand your horizons as a DM or a player. If that's the case, then it's time for you to check out The Dungeon Cast, the best D&D podcast out there that helps you passively learn all about the game just by listening. Join co-hosts Will and Brian as they break down the lore of a rich multiverse 50 years in the making in a lighthearted and beginner-friendly way. They cover everything from character creation options to tips for dungeon masters. There's something for everyone, no matter how long you've been playing TTRPGs. Find The Dungeon Cast anywhere you get podcasts or on YouTube.
This podcast is being brought to you by Voyage AC. Hey, what is this?
Aren't they beautiful? That's Voyage AC's new packaging, the gorgeous biophotonic glass. This is the hand sanitizer.
Wow, that smells amazing. And you know, I love to say biophotonic.
Yes, you do. And it's all organic, kills 99% of germs while leaving your face and hands feeling fresh. Voyage AC is your destination for the perfect gift or maybe just a little treat for yourself. So many gorgeous candles and other wonderful gifts like beachwear, diffusers, glamorous masks, face and body products. So how can our listeners find Voyage AC?
You can find everything on their website at www.voyageac.com. That's VoyageEETCIE.com.
And as you know, Melanie is willing to give my friends and family discount what? To all our listeners right now. That's right, honey. That's 10% off everything you buy.
Right. And all you need to do is enter the only one at checkout.
That's right. All you have to do is enter the only one when you make your purchase. Voyage AC is an olfactory journey of candles, perfume, and organic beauty products.
This episode is being sponsored by Cute Booty Lounge.
So, do you know what season it is?
Well, it's spring, right? Because the summer solstice isn't until June 21st.
No, I mean, it's tanning season, hun. And to show off mine, I am living for these CBL Winter White Wonderland active cute booty shorts and leggings. Mm. Cute Booty Lounge is made right here in the USA by women and for women. The company is incredible, female and minority owned, and they have these super cute patented scrunch butt pockets. There is a cute booty style for everyone. Cute Booty Lounge has you covered. Embrace your body, love your booty.
And to make it even sweeter, head to cutebootylounge.com and enter the code THEONLYBOOTY to get 15% off your first order.
I love that so much.
Yes, head to cutebootylounge.com, enter the code THEONLYBOOTY to get 15% off of your first order.
I'm Jason Pfeiffer, and I'm the only one who's optimistic about the future. I took this inherent skepticism that I had, and suddenly it clashed with people's skepticism. And I realized that, wait, on the other side of this is actually optimism. This generation's going to be okay. Everything's going to be fine.
I'm probably one of the few people I know who still looks forward to my Sunday newspaper. Not a digital copy that I read on my phone, but the real finger-staining, loud crinkling, section-by-section newspaper. The Sunday paper for me is a treat to be enjoyed while lounging in bed and sipping hot lemon water. So one day when we were going through all of the Only One stories that are being submitted to us, thank you for those, by the way. We love reading them. It was Scott's idea to record and release a few of them occasionally, but always on Sundays, and call them our Sunday edition. And because they're only 30 minutes long, our hope is that you can enjoy them while sipping your morning beverage, going for a walk, or even just enjoying a lazy Sunday at home. Please enjoy today's Sunday edition, and be sure to listen every Tuesday when we drop another brand new episode of The Only One in the Room. Jason Pfeiffer, very excited to have you here. How are you?
I am well. Thank you for having me.
I wanted to ask you before we get into the interview.
Mm-hmm.
This is a question I've never asked anybody. So I hope you're
ready.
I'm
excited to hear it. Debut question.
I want to know who your favorite Joker is. Cesar Romero, Heath Ledger, River Phoenix, Jack Nicholson, or Jared Leto?
Oh, wow. What a unexpected question. I think I've got to go with Heath Ledger.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm.
The deepest of the Jokers.
The deepest. I feel like he's the definitive Joker.
Yeah.
Even though I loved River Phoenix's performance in Joker.
I didn't see that.
Oh.
I have to admit.
It was Joaquin. Oh. It wasn't River.
Did I say River?
I mean, River could have been himself into
Joaquin. We have to redo it.
No. Okay. We got that on tape.
Joaquin Phoenix. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. Wow. Yeah. I need to write that out. But yes. So you did not see River Phoenix because he did not play the Joker.
No. Well, so as your time for entertainment consumption dwindles,
yes,
you have to make choices. And the choice that I have made is that I will only be engaging with whatever it is that my wife is interested in, because I'm not going to sit around and watch something by myself. Like I don't watch movies or TV by myself. I really only watch it with her as a thing to just kind of chill out with in the evening.
Yeah.
And my wife has pretty much lost interest in anything that might make her feel bad. Like we're really only interested in uplifting stuff over here.
Good for her.
So Joker was just out. I mean, I never even, I would have, 10 years ago, I would have just gone to the movies and watched that myself. But that we don't have time for that anymore.
Right, right.
So it's out.
I understand that. Scott and I do that. Not with occasionally we'll watch something dark, but we chill in the evening. That's like our time together.
And I have a time limit. No, nothing dark after 8 o'clock.
Yeah, that's true.
I don't sleep well, and it makes me sad.
We used to watch The Sopranos at night, and he's like, we can't do that before bed. Back in the day,
I feel for your wife. I respect that.
Yeah, and she's caused us to bail on some stuff that I was enjoying, but that got too dark or just got unfun. Maybe it was serious and that's fine, but then it just took a turn.
And she's
out. And if she's out, then I'm out. Like, I could watch it myself, but when the hell am I going to do that?
Right.
I'm not going to do that.
Right.
So it just is what it is.
Yeah, and you're right. Time is at a premium, so it's like that's the time you're going to spend with her. I totally understand that.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. And I am Laura Cathcart Robbins, and this is the Only One in the Room special Sunday edition. But I am never the only one in this room because, as usual, my boyfriend, producer, and co-host, Scott Slaughter, who I call Hun, is here as well.
Hi, honey.
Hey, Hun. So today we're talking to Jason Pfeiffer.
Yeah.
He is the editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine and the host of 2 podcasts, really making us look bad.
Busy guy. Well, he watches less TV now.
Yeah. He's the host of Bill for Tomorrow, which is a show about things from history that shaped us and how we can shape the future, and Problem Solvers, which is a show about entrepreneurs solving unexpected problems in their business. So welcome, Jason. Welcome again. And, you know, the first thing I always ask our guests is, how do you identify?
I don't know that I've ever really thought about that. I identify with, like, myself. I guess I mostly think of myself. Here's my way into that question, is that I've spent a lot of time with friends talking about parenthood because I have 2 kids. And a thing that I always say that I know, like, makes some people uncomfortable, which is just like, I really don't identify as being a father. Like, if I had a list of things that are my identities, father is pretty low on that list, which is not to say I don't love my kids. I love my kids, but I just don't. It's not the thing that I like aspired to be. It's not the role I envelop in. Like, I really think of myself as a storyteller and as someone who wants to help people and make people think differently.
Yeah.
And I'm always like, I wake up every morning trying to figure out how to do that best. And that's the thing that I suppose I identify with the most.
Well, that is really interesting. And that kind of segues nicely into the subject that I wanted to talk to you about, which is your childhood. You talked to me about being a curious but kind of skeptical kid. Is that true?
Yeah, I was a curious but skeptical kid. I was a very skeptical kid about everything. And I mean, like my turn towards optimism came later. I think that I have a memory of being in seventh grade or something and having some girl in my class scold me for always saying that I didn't like things. Like, stop saying that you don't like this. What do you like? And I don't know. I just, when I was younger, identified, I think, in a way by the things that I didn't like. I gravitated towards communities that felt in a way defined against something else. Like the punk rock community was very much about punk, but it was really also about, you know, like throwing the middle finger to other things. And I was deeply skeptical of basically everything that was put in front of me. I remember that teacher, I would ask teachers and I would ask my parents constantly, why am I learning this? Why are you teaching this to me? Why do I have to know this? And I was never satisfied with their answers. I mean, I think back, I'm still not really satisfied with their answers. I don't think that traditional education is a really good way of teaching people. But I was always looking for questioning stuff. And I think in a way, I mean, now that I think about it, and I suppose this is jumping chronologically, perhaps too much for you, but I'll say it and then you can back me back up. I think that I just discovered that that instinct doesn't have to lead you to negative places, because sometimes you can, if you turn the skepticism towards people's skepticism, then you discover that actually a lot of what people are concerned about is garbage, and that the real answer is more complicated but also more optimistic than the narrative tends to lend itself towards.
Really interesting. We're going to take just a quick break to tell you about a cool new product that Scott and I discovered, and we'll get back to our guest's amazing Only One story in just a minute.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Hey, it's Mae Whitman, and I play Frankie in the new Realm podcast, The Sisters. The Sisters is about a museum curator of medical oddities who investigates the origins of a mutated skeleton with two layers of bones. Soon, she uncovers an extraordinary mystery that connects her present with one family's tragic past in hauntingly dangerous ways. Listen to The Sisters wherever you get your podcasts.
This actually has nothing to do with what I wanted to talk to you about. I think you told me a story about bringing your blanket to college.
Oh yeah. So you're almost correct. The blanket actually didn't come to college, but the blanket intersected with college, right? So I hung on to old things,
yes,
in a ridiculous way. I was really resistant to change and to new things for a very long time. So the story that my mom always likes to remind me of, I remember it perfectly fine without all the reminders, but I had this blanket, this blue and white striped blanket, right? Like blankie level blanket, right? From when I was a little kid.
I love
kid.
That.
Yeah. And I had it from as long as I can remember. And at some point, I got old enough that my mom was like, maybe it's time for a grown-up blanket. Mm. And that might have started in middle school. I'm not sure, but she definitely put the hard push on in high school. And I was not interested in this. Like, why? I mean, I can sort of channel my attitude at the time, which was like, why would I need this new blanket when I have the other blanket and it works great, right? Like, this is the blanket that I have. Why are you giving me a new one? I don't need it.
Yeah.
And so I kept sleeping with this blue and white, raggedy, like constantly falling apart. Once I learned how to sew, I was constantly sewing this thing back together. And then I went off to college. Mm. And I didn't bring the blanket with me because that, I think, was a bridge too far. But whenever I would come home on breaks,
yes,
I would go into my room and there sitting on my bed would be the new blanket. Mm-hmm. And it would be nicely made and tucked in. And like my mom was like, and I would, the first thing I would do every single time that I got home from college is I would rip that thing off the bed,
right.
I'd fold it back up, I'd put it in the closet, I'd find my old blankie, and I'd put that on my bed, and then that's what I would sleep with. And I did that all through college. And that was a pattern for me. I was so resistant. If you gave me something new, I didn't use it. If something new came along, I resented it. Mm-hmm. And I did that for so long.
Yeah. Well, and then so now this segues nicely to the next thing, which is, I think it was 6 years ago. You were a senior editor at Fast Company. Is that right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you found this article written about the 20s, or written in the 20s, rather, about the new generation. So this is like, you're this person who's skeptical and questions everything, but you're also kind of resistant to change if you don't see a need for it, mm-hmm. right, in certain areas of your life. And then you find this article that is historical.
Yeah.
And tell me about the article and how it impacted you.
Right. So this is possibly even longer than 6 years ago, but I found this piece, and it was, I don't know what I was doing, but I came across this piece, and it was about how the younger generation of the time, I think we're talking about the 20s, the younger generation of the time is entitled and lazy, mm-hmm. and expects things to just be handed to them, mm. and on and on. And I'm reading this, and it occurs to me that this is exactly what people have said about millennials, and I'm a sort of cusp millennial, mm-hmm. and that I'm hearing this conversation happen right now in my own time.
Yes.
And now I'm reading it happen from generations ago. And I step back and I think, what would have happened if this is true? Right? Because the interesting thing about history, and this was one of the things that sent me down this path of being fascinated by history. I wasn't really interested in history as a student, I guess because I was too busy asking, why are you teaching me this?
Yeah.
And so as a student, it didn't make any sense to me. But now that I saw this, I realized, you know, there are conversations from the past that we know the answers to now, which is kind of a profound thing, because the most boring debate in the world is about something that hasn't happened yet, or that something is kind of unprovable and only provable by time. So if people are sitting around, they're like, millennials are entitled. And someone else, millennials are not entitled. Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's like nowhere to go with it. It's so boring. But if you rewind to this same conversation from the 20s, well, now you can actually see what happened.
Right.
And you can see that the next generation wasn't actually worse than the previous generation. Actually, they continued the progress from the previous generation. And that if the idea that a new generation was worse than the previous generation, if that is true, mm-hmm. then we would be on a steady decline.
Right.
You and I would be, we wouldn't be talking through technology right now. We would be rolling around in like mud somewhere because that's that's the only thing that would exist. But that's not what happened. What happened is that we built and we built. And I became fascinated with this. And I started looking for other examples, of which there are an endless variety of examples of people from the past who said something that was exactly like what we're talking about today, except that now we know it didn't turn out to be true. So you can find all these people talking about how radio was addictive, for example, in the same way that people now talk about social media being addictive. The same language, the same form. It's in medical journals. This time is different, right? It's, you can always find this. But we know now what happened. Radio wasn't addictive. I mean, wouldn't it be nice if it was? Because that means that everyone would be like listening to every episode of your show on repeat.
Yes.
But that's not. It's just not how it was. And so I think that this actually harnessed. I think this might have been the turning point. I don't really know, but where I took this inherent skepticism that I had, and suddenly it clashed with people's skepticism. And I realized that, wait, on the other side of this is actually optimism. This generation's going to be okay. Everything's going to be fine. The technology that we're worried about, it's going to be fine. We're all going to be okay. Right. Like, we just are. I'm telling you, we are. History tells us that we are. And so that set me down this path. I mean, that's what Build for Tomorrow is based off of, my podcast. It's really me trying to understand and explore this in every possible avenue and see, like, what are we missing in the conversations that we're having today? Because we just don't have the perspective on it.
No. Can you tell me a little bit about what you found out about Russia hacking our elections?
Oh yeah, sure. That sounds like a hard pivot, but it's not actually.
No, it's not. It's in line with what you're talking about.
Right. I like that. That would be an interesting experience. You could just go out, but whatever somebody said, follow up with. And can you tell me
about Russia?
What Russia did.
Yeah, right.
So here's the thing. 2016. And then to a degree 2020, but obviously 2016 was the big one, where the narrative was, and not just a narrative, I mean, Russia did everything that it possibly could think of to interfere with the American elections. And that's a fact. I certainly wouldn't dispute that. That is true. But what you heard from politicians and from people in the media was this one word. And that word was unprecedented. That this was an unprecedented attack using unprecedented methods. And that's not true. That's not true. That's not me reading a couple articles. That's me. That was me interviewing a whole lot of people, including most notably this guy named David Shimer, who is a fellow at the Wilson Center and at Yale University, and wrote this book, which was really interesting, called Rigged: America, Russia, and 100 Years of Covert Electoral Interference. And the argument that he makes very convincingly, with lots and lots of examples throughout history, is that Russia has been doing the same thing for 100 years. And in fact, Russia is not the first country to come up with trying to interfere with American elections. If you want to find the very first example of foreign interference in American elections, well, then rewind yourself to 1796, when France tried to interfere in the very first contested election in American history. So we've always been dealing with this. And you could say, well, but it's never Facebook and Twitter, and that's never been around. And fine, that's true. Facebook and Twitter wasn't around in the 60s. But other technology was. Other technology that felt just as powerful as Facebook and Twitter does today.
Like
radio,
what? Radio,
television, right? Prior to radio and television, newspapers.
Yeah.
The means of communication. What are the means of communication? And how can Russia use those means of communication to exacerbate existing divisions in American society? That's the playbook. Mm. And that's what they've been doing forever. And is it reasonable to ask and explore whether or not social media platforms today could do a better job of not being a tool for this kind of interference? Absolutely. That's a conversation that should be had. But the reason that I dig into this is because when we talk about this as if it is unprecedented,
right,
then we are acting as if it never happened before, and that therefore the solution must lie in addressing something that's brand new. Mm-hmm. And I am telling you right now that if you shut down Facebook and Twitter before the next election, Russia would just find some other means of communication to use. Like, it's not the problem. You can't, if you threw Mark Zuckerberg in jail, you don't solve this problem. And this is something that we as a culture do far too often to ourselves. It is a self-inflicted harm, which is that we treat old things as new. And when we do that, we inhibit our ability to actually identify problems and come up with solutions.
So what do you see as a possible solution for it besides throwing Mark Zuckerberg in jail?
Well, I mean, are we speaking specifically about Russian interference? I mean, look, this is not my deep area of expertise, is like foreign affairs and election integrity. But I can tell you that when I asked David Shimer that question, he gave me like a 10-minute answer, which was basically everybody at every step of the way has to be better. Right. So this is not right. This is not, you can't outsource the solution to somebody else. You can't have a bunch of politicians. I mean, this should make everybody angry, right? You can't have a bunch of politicians sit around and say that the problem is Mark Zuckerberg when the politicians themselves are problems as well, right? Right. Like, everybody has to be accountable. And that includes you and me, too. We as consumers have to be smarter about the information that's being presented to us. And we have to start thinking, where could this be coming from? And is there an agenda behind it, right? So
thinking for ourselves?
Can you believe it?
No.
Every stakeholder here. Is responsible, right? You can't, and this thing just drives me crazy. That because I mean, you could take this, which is a very serious and weighty subject, and I can follow it up, and I'm happy to if you want, like with like participation trophies, which is feels like a ridiculous subject, but is actually the same exact problem.
I was going to ask you that next.
So I've queued it up. So where what we're doing is identifying some problem, real or imagined, real in the case of Russian interference, imagined in the case of participation trophies, but then we're basically exporting it to somebody else. Or we're saying, I'm not the problem. So this whole thing over here is the problem. And when you, like, we all have to take responsibility here. So so David Shimer's answer, it was very detailed, and I won't be able to reproduce it nearly as well. But basically he was like, politicians have a role to play. Media have a role to play. Our institutions have a role to play. Our consumers have a role to play. Everybody has a role to play. We all have to understand that when you are a part of a nation as powerful as America, literally everybody inside and outside of America feels like they're going to have a stake in the outcome of an election, and they are coming for it. Mm-hmm. And if you sit around and you think that just one social media platform is the solution or the cause of all of this, well, you are missing the problem. And in fact, for that matter, there's been really interesting research now that it's years later and we are actually able to look at the data, which has found that that the misinformation that we're all concerned about actually reached like a substantially smaller amount of people than we thought it did, and it had a negligible effect on voter intent. So it was there, but it may not have actually had the impact that we thought it did. So anyway, there's my rant on that.
Yeah, I just want to make sure I understand your optimism here. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because, like, in the case of the new generation being ruined, whatever the new generation is, you know, in the 1920s or in the 1940s or whatever that generation is, being ruined by the technology or whatever we're talking about, you're optimistic because you're in the future and you see that it wasn't ruined and that things have gotten better. Is that correct?
I'm optimistic because let me sort of contrast a thought. I think the reason why we often have a pessimistic narrative about culture is because when we treat old things as new, we believe that we are in a time in which there is some kind of introduction of a new decline. Mm-hmm. So if Russian hacking of elections is a brand new thing that is made possible by brand new technology, then we have created, if that is true, which it's not, but if that is true, then we have created a more dangerous world, right? Mm. That feels like a pessimistic way of looking at things.
Right.
And I understand that in the same way that if you watched The Social Network, that horror show created by Tristan Harris, you'd come away thinking that we've doomed ourselves. We've created technology that is far superior than our own, you know, abilities to withstand its allure,
mm-hmm.
and that we are now subject to its whims, right? We give fully into what's called technological determinism, idea that our technology is the driving force that determines the world, and that we've unleashed the monster, we unleashed the Kraken. But if you are to actually put these things into historical context, what you see is that although we have this same fear across time, it never actually comes true, right? Like, we're actually on much steadier ground than we think we are, and we're not doing significant new damage to ourselves. Now, I realize this doesn't, you can't take what I just said and apply it to literally everything in the world. Like, I understand that there are bad things in the world. Climate change is a terrible thing, and that is we're making that worse and worse. But like, by and large, like most of the things that we're going to be talking about in our day-to-day lives and worrying about and experiencing are things that we think that they're new, and they're simply not. Mm. And so my optimism comes from knowing that we can create solutions, and that we are far more adaptable and resilient than we give ourselves credit for being.
I love that. That was so articulate. My goodness.
We're gonna have to slow it down on the re-edit just so we can get it off.
No, it was great.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
All right. So I do want to hear about participation trophies. And then I have just a couple more questions before we wrap up. So I really like this because, you know, I was one of those moms who fought for my kids to get participation trophies.
Oh, good.
Yes. And was judged for that because by the moms whose kids really excelled in those sports were angry that everybody got a trophy when their kids actually won one. So tell me your thoughts about them.
Okay, so the narrative that you hear is that this generation of kids grew up where everyone got a trophy, and therefore extrapolate that they're entitled and mm-hmm. they don't understand that winning takes work, et cetera, et cetera. Okay.
Right.
Now, that's a familiar argument, and you might agree with it, you might disagree with it, but I'm willing to bet that you have swallowed whole one part of this story that is foundational and also the easiest to fact check and also is just definitively untrue.
Mm.
And that is the part where we say this generation. Because participation trophies have been around for 100 years. 100 years. The origin of participation trophies, like super quick, is that basically after school became mandatory, which took a couple decades. Like it started in Massachusetts in the late 1800s, and by the early 1900s, it was mandated countrywide. And then there was a question, which is there's a thing called free time, and what do kids do with their free time? Mm. And so the answer was sports, and so school system started to create these youth sports leagues. That was the beginning of youth sports leagues. And then these youth sports leagues got competitive as they do. And the people of the time, particularly the 20s and 30s, they didn't like this. They had just come out of World War I. They'd seen what like horrible competition so to speak,
yes.
like, looks like. And they just didn't want this for their children. And they started to turn against youth sports. And a lot of school systems shut down their youth sports programs, which just created a private opportunity, which is where things like Little League come from. And anyway, the solution to being able to have the sport but make it not about competition was participation trophies. And so they were introduced in the 20s, and we had them ever since. And so boomers today who say this generation of young kids, they all got trophies. Well, I have news for you. You boomers got participation trophies too.
Right.
I know you're going to tell me that you didn't, but you did. And the only reason that you don't remember it is because it wasn't important. Right. It's just it wasn't a big deal. And so but here we have a thing where once again, We're treating an old thing as new. We think that we're identifying some kind of problem. We're trying to make a complex world very simple, right? It's so attractive to say, well, because of this, that. Because I don't like that, I can identify this particular problem. And that's not how the world works. Right. We do ourselves a disservice by trying to simplify and create like narratives where there aren't, and to believe that we are witnessing the birth of something instead of the continuation of something.
Yes. Thank you. Well, and that is the idea that this generation is suffering because everybody gets a W, kind of, or, you know, everybody who participates comes away with something. If you can look back and say that every generation before you had the same thing and you guys are okay. But people don't know that. They have no idea.
People don't realize this, but they are the evidence that change can be good.
Yes.
Like, you are the evidence. You come from the future. Right. You are the product of change. And then the crazy thing is that then change comes along to you and you're like, oh, well, this is terrible. You literally are the example of how change can be good. And people don't seem to understand that.
Oh, that's so great. Okay, so just a couple more things.
Yeah.
You're writing a book now, right?
Yes.
Is it called How to Find Opportunity and Change?
No, that's just what it is.
Okay.
it's called, well, at least tentatively, it comes out in August of 2022. So anything could happen.
Anything could happen, yeah.
But right now it's called Build for Tomorrow, Not for Yesterday.
Okay. All right. I love that. So that's, you're working on that now. And then Mr. Nice Guy, that's currently being developed for television. Is that correct?
It is. Although if you've ever had anything developed for television, then developed for television means that you signed some paperwork and people said like very impressive things to you a year and a half ago and then you never heard from them again. So, last we heard, they're still at work at it. When we signed that deal, we were like, we just bought a lottery ticket. Right. And well, you know, I don't stay up at night. You don't stay up at night, like hoping for the lottery ticket. Right. Like to me, life is in part about just like buying as many lottery tickets as you can.
Right. So that wasn't we won the lottery, is we just bought a ticket.
We just bought a ticket.
Yeah.
And, you know, if it works out, then great.
Yeah. And just really quickly, what is it about Mr. Nice Guy?
So for a very hard left turn from our conversation. So Mr. Nice Guy is a novel that I wrote with my wife it's a romantic comedy, and it is about two people who each week sleep together and then critically review each other's sexual performance in a magazine.
Oh.
And it was a idea that I had in my 20s, inspired by
relationship.
Not a sexual relationship. A sex columnist had reached out to me asking for like writing and freelance writing advice, and we corresponded for a while. And in that very professional correspondence, I just came up with this idea. It was like, you know, what if there was a sex columnist and she slept with somebody else, and they like wrote this back and forth, almost like dueling. You know, like imagine if. Imagine if like you reviewed a restaurant and then the restaurant reviewed you.
Right.
And then you just went back and forth.
Yeah.
And so like, what would that be like if you applied honesty to the thing that nobody is ever really fully honest about? I didn't know how to write this. I'm not a fiction writer. And so I tried a number of times and I just kept failing. But I would tell my friends this idea and everyone thought it was funny. And then I met my wife and she, when we were dating, she encouraged me to try to write it, and I like tried again and I failed. And anyway, it turns out that the solution to writing a novel that when you don't know how to write is to marry a novelist.
Yes.
Because my wife is a novelist.
Yeah.
And so after she sold her second novel, this was years and years ago, she asked me what I thought she should write next. And I said, just write my book. Like, I'm never going to do this myself. Just write it. And she was like, no, why don't we? We'll do it together. And so we did it together.
Oh, that's great.
And it was great. And it came out a couple of years ago, and we had a lot of fun.
That's awesome. I'll have to check that out.
Please.
Mr. Nice Guy. So tell me, Mr. Nice Guy, where can people find you, Jason?
Yeah. You know, can I just say, people have asked me many times. They're like, oh, so you wrote a book called Mr. Nice Guy. Are you the Mr. Nice Guy? And it's
like,
that would be the most obnoxious thing. if that's what I had done. Where can people find me? They can find me at jasonfeifer.com,
yes.
jasonfeifer.com. If you do that and you go up to the top, there's a little thing that says free training, and you can click that, and you will be taken to get my free audio course on how to find opportunity and change and to feel more optimistic, basically what we've been talking about.
Wow.
And I break it down into fun steps. And then also, you know, check out Build for Tomorrow. You can hear more about participation trophies and why people banned teddy bears in 1907 and everything in between.
Yes, you can. I love your podcast. I'm so glad that we had you on as a guest. You're just like this on the podcast. You're enthusiastic and you're informative and you're educated and you're fun and you make it really intriguing. Like, I want to listen to it through the end so I can see what it is that you're so excited about, you know? But and then I get it when you get to the end. And I told you the first thing we talked about was I forgot the exact title, but it was something like When Was America Great?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was such a great episode. So definitely listen to Build for Tomorrow. And I want to say thank you so much for this. And this was such a pleasure. I could hear you talk forever, listen to you talk forever. And
thank you.
You should actually do voiceover, by the way.
Yeah.
You would be amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a fun idea. I would love to.
You have a great voice for it.
You do. And he has all the animation in his voice, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, so
I have I have a friend who's doing is building a meditation app and sent me a script for like a meditation to read, which I haven't had time to do yet, but I think is hilarious because
I don't think of me as meditative
at all. But she was like, I think you'd be perfect for it.
I was thinking like Toy Story, yeah. One of the toys. Like
you've got to send me that when you do it so I can hear because I can't picture it at all. But thank you so much, Jason.
Thank you, guys. This was such a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to The Only One in the Room. Please join us each Tuesday and Sunday for an incredible brand new Only One interview. And every Friday for On My Nightstand, where I'll be reading something that I love. If you have an Only One story you'd like to share or a piece of writing you'd like to submit, please send it to theonlyonepod@gmail.com. From all of us at The Only One in the Room, we wish you dopeness, health, and prosperity.
Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Buntwine, erstwhile monk turned traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world. That ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Buntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.